How are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
First off, we would like to know your involvement with Reed. So how did you first get involved with Reed?
Well, I had already been a professor here for several years, and I was teaching creative nonfiction in the creative writing program and the MFA program. And Nick Taylor was the faculty advisor for Reed at that point. And then he became the director of the Steinbeck Center. And so suddenly now this opportunity became open to run Reed Magazine, which I saw as a plum assignment. And so I said, I'm in.
So what drew you to the Bay Area? Was it just, it wasn't just the weather?
No, it's interesting. I had lived in all different parts of the Bay Area. I had lived in San Francisco several years ago, and then I moved up to Napa. And then I got the travel bug, and I sold my house, and I took all that money and traveled around Europe for the better part of a year. And so when the money started to run out, I thought, maybe I should try to find another job. And so I was staying in a hotel in Madrid, and I got online, and I looked at the teaching jobs, and there was one at San Jose State. And I said, wow, it's amazing that not only is there a job at San Jose State in creative writing, but it's a job in my field. And I thought, well, I'm not going to get it because everybody wants to live in the Bay Area, but I'll just apply. And so I did get it. Here I am. When I got the job here, of course, I became acquainted. Well, we have one of the few urban campuses in America that has this kind of enormous 154-acre campus in the heart of a downtown urban area. So that, for me, was very attractive, and to also become integrated into the downtown arts scene. And, you know, a lot of college campuses are either in small towns or, you know, they're in the middle of nowhere. And so to be part of all of this activity was very exciting.
Let's get it to Reed, because your background is obviously nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
So has nonfiction shaped the nature of Reed Magazine?
I think that definitely since I came on board, I have boosted the nonfiction visibility in Reed. It was there, but it was kind of an also-ran. It was not, you know, there never were that many pieces published in nonfiction. So when I came in, that was one of my initial goals. And so I solicited work from a lot of the nonfiction writers I knew, and also wanted to really upgrade the quality of nonfiction. Then we were able to start the Gabrielle Rico Award, and when we began offering prize money, that, of course, really elevated the quality of submissions for nonfiction.
So you were one of the people that got that going?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Gabrielle Rico was a wonderful professor at San Jose State, and she passed away suddenly. And she was a writing professor, and her family wanted to do something to honor her memory. And so I said, how about a contest for Reed for nonfiction? And they loved that idea.
So we're curious about the origin of Reed, just the name itself, and the significance of whoever this Reed character is.
James Frazier Reed was an enormous personality in the development of San Jose. And, you know, as you know, Reed has been here since, you know, the beginning of San Jose, basically, since the beginning of San Jose State. In fact, in California and on the West Coast, it's very unusual to have a cultural institution that has lasted this long. And I think we just, you know, we take it for granted, but this is something I really want to draw attention to as we celebrate the 150th anniversary, because James Frazier Reed was a member of the Donner Party, and when he survived that, obviously it was a very traumatic event, he brought his family here, and they settled on a 500-acre ranch, which later became downtown San Jose. And he had lobbied really hard to make San Jose the capital of California. And when he lost that and Sacramento was chosen as the capital, he donated all the land where San Jose State is today for that purpose. And then if you look around the streets around downtown, the streets like Martha, these are named after, and Reed, of course, is named after, these are named after his family.
We're both on the nonfiction editing team, right? Mm-hmm. And you are a nonfiction writer, mm-hmm. and you push for quality nonfiction. What to you is quality nonfiction? What are the marks of great creative nonfiction?
I think the number one is that the writer has a very powerful voice and a unique voice. This is something that can carry a nonfiction story, because nonfiction, the kind of nonfiction we publish and read, is very much like a dialogue. It's very conversational. And it's usually intimate. You know, you feel like you're sitting down and somebody's telling you a story and you're really getting to know this person. And for me, this is the great gift of literature, is having this human connection. Because you might not even know the darkest secrets of your best friend or your mother or your father. A lot of times we keep those things hidden. But there's something that happens when people write, that they will open up their heart and soul and talk about these issues that have shaped them. And if you read the collection that we have in, like, our last issue of Reed, it really covers the whole gambit of human experience. So I would say an incredible voice, but also that it touches on a universal theme. It's not just, oh, this is my story about my sister dying from cancer. That the author is able to open up that story so that everybody who's ever, you know, had a family member suffer from an illness or has experienced loss, this author is now speaking to them, and they can relate to each other.
I agree with that.
That's put very beautifully.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think this is actually an incredible opportunity through literature to bridge these gaps that seem to be growing in our country. You know, people of different races, you know, pitted against one another, or people in different economic brackets, because it's easy to vilify somebody as the other when you don't understand them and you don't connect with them. But then you read, I think nonfiction writing is the great bridge between all different groups, you know. And so when you read a story, somebody who was sold into human trafficking, or somebody who came here as a refugee from Syria, and you understand, oh, this is somebody like me, but they just went through this nightmarish hell. And so it really tends to break down those barriers. You know, I'm also a travel writer, and I think travel writing is one of the greatest gifts of nonfiction writing, to understand all different cultures and all different types of people.
I think nonfiction gives people a certain profundity, a certain insight into someone that's different than them. Nonfiction, like you said, offers a bridge. It's an avenue. It's something people can connect to each other, right?
Yeah.
Totally agreed.
An example of like a really great nonfiction work that certainly shapes how people think is Eli Wiesel's Night, which is a really powerful work of nonfiction, because he talks about what we're touching on is like this universal theme and the horrors of what humans can do to other humans and the extremes to which people suffer. That's definitely what we're touching on, is connecting with that.
Yeah, it's about getting the story out.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not exposed to other cultures, other experiences,
yeah,
you're limiting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's about branching out to what I said earlier, the human experience. You have to branch out. You can't, because we were talking about with this racial divide that we're going through, it's because people aren't exposing themselves to mm-hmm. people that are different than them.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
They're creating this illusion or what other people are like when they haven't even experienced other people.
And that's something that even beyond nonfiction we strive to do with Reed, is really represent the diversity that is San Jose and the Bay Area in general, you know, to showcase that we have a lot of different points of view. There are 103 languages spoken on this campus.
So what can a student expect to gain from enrolling in REED?
I think a student can expect to gain the most important thing about a college education, which is not only a learning experience, but also real-world experience that's going to carry you beyond just a classroom and help you to get a job when you go out into the workplace. And I've seen several of my students who have done that. Even if you have no desire to work in publishing, you know, all the things that we do in here, copy editing, design, editorial skills, marketing, sales, if you get any kind of job from a startup to at Apple Computer, those skills are really going to be valued.
So just be honest with me. Every <Uh-oh>. Semester, is it a pain in the ass having a new staff every year?
Yes. It's a challenge because if I didn't have to lose everybody at one time, it would not be so hard. If I had like half the people stay over and train the rest of the other staff, but that's just not the way that the class is structured. And so the good part of it is I get a whole new group with fresh ideas and enthusiasm. They're not blasé, and so they come in, and every year I learn things. The magazine evolves. I think if you look at the trajectory of the magazine throughout the past decade, that's easily seen, you know, how each year it's changed, and I like to think it's gotten better.
With that said, what are your expectations every year?
My expectations are that the staff takes their job very seriously, and I try at the beginning of the semester to really stress this is not the kind of passive course where you're going to go and just listen to a faculty member lecture and then take a test or write a paper. You are going to be participating full throttle from the beginning of the semester, and we have a standard to maintain, and this magazine is going to be in print with your name on it, so we don't want to have it be an embarrassment. And so we are the stewards of a tradition that has gone on for 150 years. And I see, you know, almost universally, the students do take that to heart. They take it very seriously, and they're usually really excited to be part of this legacy.
Well, I guess, how do you work around that? How have you found a cohesive way to make sure the magazine has kept up its standards, given that challenge?
That's a good question. I'm trying more and more each year to write scripts, mm-hmm. so, you know, to expedite the training, give people guidelines. Also, as you've seen this year so far, we have some of our previous staff members, all of whom have volunteered mm-hmm. to come in. I haven't asked any of those people. They just volunteered. They wanted to come in and share their experiences. And so I also connect, like today, the copy editor, the lead copy editor, I connected her with last year's copy editor. And I've been kind of amazed, frankly, how generous people are with their time. You know, they've moved on. And as I said, a lot of them have gotten jobs where they're very busy and they're utilizing the skills that they learned on REED. So it's kind of a sacrifice for them to make time to do this, but they do.
Do you have a favorite magazine? That something that you aspire REED to look like or be?
I think one of my favorite literary journals is the Paris Review, and it's very respected and renowned in the history of American letters, and so I like that they have representations of all genres, and also they do these great author profiles.
I noticed that Read 69 had author profiles. Mm-hmm. Was that the first time? Or?
No, we've done that for the past two or three issues, mm-hmm. but that kind of grew out of our relationship with our readers and understanding that most of our readership are other authors, and so they want to learn about. Everybody's fascinated by writing process, right? If you go to a lot of literary events, as I do, the universal question is to ask the author, talk about your writing process, because it's a mystery. This happens, you know, behind closed doors. And so we wanted to bring that out in the open a little bit. So one of the questions we always ask is, talk about your writing process. And also these profiles are people that have a connection to the Bay Area. What I hope to achieve with Reed is that we are on the same quality level as other literary journals, you know, most of whom have professional staff. And so I think we have as much talent as they do. It's just getting everybody up to speed very quickly once the semester starts in the fall.
So what motivates you? What keeps you going?
There's a quote by John Keats, and it says, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." And I was thinking about this quote. I really love for things to be beautiful, and this is one of the fun things for me about Reed, is that it's also a visual experience, and I myself am an artist. And so, and my apartment, you know, my home, I really like beauty. But I also like beauty in, like, a piece that's written well. And so this is what keeps me going, is this constant striving to make things better, as close to perfection as you can. Of course, as artists, this is a lifelong pursuit, and we know we'll never achieve perfection, but it's something that is never boring.
I'm wondering, who are some of your favorite artists, perhaps visual artists, and then favorite authors?
Favorite visual artists. I'm a big fan of the Expressionists and the Impressionists. I was in Paris in February for my birthday, mm-hmm. and so it was wonderful. I went to the D'Orsay and got to see a lot of these works in person. Monet, Manet, Degas, Renoir. Their use of color is incredible, but also I like representational art. I'm not a big fan of abstract art. I know that.
I don't think anyone is.
That's what Tom Wolfe says. He says it's all kind of an emperor's new clothes idea. So and Van Gogh actually happens to be one of my favorites because of his incredible use of color. So, and as far as authors, I have Truman Capote as one of my favorites mm-hmm. of all time. He's an incredible stylist, beautiful prose. And you see with somebody like him, he started out as a fiction writer, and then he invented what he called the nonfiction novel. But you can see this, and also he's a Southerner, so as a fellow Southerner, you know, we have this special bond. And the thing that I think is a wonderful quality in Southern writers, for some reason, they are master storytellers. And he's an incredible storyteller. Likewise, Mark Twain, who's from my home state of Missouri, just that ability to spin a yarn and keep you spellbound, and his wonderful sense of humor. Hunter Thompson is another one. He's, you know, outrageous and, again, a wonderful storyteller. He was one of the pioneers of creative nonfiction, and so I've really admired him for that. His ability, his voice is unique in all the world. So for humor, I love Dave Barry. I think he won the Pulitzer Prize for humor writing, and I think that was well-deserved. And I've studied his work quite a bit. And then the last one on that list was Herb Cain, the columnist from San Francisco. He wrote a column for the San Francisco Chronicle for 60 years. That's an incredible body of work that I think is unparalleled. And again, he had this ability as a columnist to very quickly sketch an idea and just bring you with like a line or two into a world. And So that's fascinating to me.
Bay Area legend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So do you have any major works in progress?
I do. I do. I'm finally working on what my friends have encouraged me to write for years. And the working title is The Book Behind the Books. Because when I would go out on assignment and write my nonfiction books, a lot of these were stories of people or places and not really stories about me. And so when I would come home, I would tell the gals in my writing group, oh my God, you can't believe what happened when I was out doing this research and this story. Because these assignments have taken me all over the world. And they would say, these are the stories we want to read. I mean, this is wild stuff. And so one of the pieces that is coming out actually the end of this month is called Sacrifices, Desires, New Moon. It's a story about me being on assignment in Brazil, and I was in a house in the middle of the night that was invaded by robbers who tried to kidnap me, and then I escaped. And so this will definitely make its way into the book.
I wanted to initially ask about your previous work, Desert Flower. What was it like writing that?
Well, that was an amazing experience. I had just graduated from graduate school, and I got a phone call one day. I was really go-getter when I got out of school, and I already had a literary agent. And so she called me. I'd been out of school 2 months, and she said, I answered the phone. I'm living in this old farmhouse in the middle of an Amish corn patch in rural Pennsylvania. And she called, and she said, I have a strange proposition for you. Yes. She said, how would you like to write the life story of a supermodel? And I'm going, really? Does it have to be a supermodel? I mean, you know, couldn't it be like a female astronaut or politician? She says, no, I know what you're thinking, but it's not like that. So she began to tell me this story about Horace Deary, and I was amazed. And so within a month, I'm on a train for Manhattan to go up to New York and interview her. And so we sat down with a tape recorder, and she told me her whole life story. And then I organized this. And the real challenge of this was to do something I'd never done, which was to write the book in her voice, as if I were she. So this was a bit like fiction writing. And it felt kind of uncomfortable at a point, but then I thought, well, she's going to read the whole book, so if things are not right, she's going to correct it. But this book has had an incredible impact. And, you know, hats off to Horace for being brave enough to tell her story, because you can imagine going through this kind of mutilation. Here's a woman who, as a supermodel, she's all about selling sex. So once somebody knows, oh yeah, you've been mutilated, you've had your clitoris cut off, and enjoying sex is out of the question, that's pretty much going to be the end of your modeling career. So that's pretty brave. But the United Nations told me that this book has done more to help them with their campaign to end female genital mutilation than anything they've ever tried. And it's sold over 11 million copies at this point and was banned in Somalia. I'm happy to say I'm the author of a banned book, and but has been translated into 55 languages and made into a feature film. I heard an incredible story. The director of the film said when it was premiered in Ethiopia, at the end of the movie in the theater, all of these men simultaneously stood up and said to the audience, we had no idea this was what was involved with cutting our girls. We had no idea this is what went on. We will never let this happen to our daughters.